We'll be back in a moment. We'll continue our discussion with Matthew Alper about his book, his work, of course, The God Part of the Brain, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Matthew, let's go through some of the research which would back up your theories, your theories of neuron theology.
Okay. Well, I'll start with the neurophysiological research that's been done over the last 10 years or so. It sort of started off with a Dr. Ramachandran at UC San Diego who specialized in epilepsy and found that a very large percentage of those who came to him who had something called temporal lobe epilepsy had a high degree of hyper-religiosity. They were extremely religious people. They spoke of God a lot, and he found this kind of curious, and he started doing some research. What he found was, for some reason, a very high percentage of these people are very religious, and that during their seizures, they have religious experiences. So a high degree of temporal lobe epileptics in the midst of their seizures, seconds before their seizures, during, and then after, they have these very intense religious experiences, and they sometimes, right after their seizure, they come out and they're crying and they're full of a feeling of ecstasy that they've been touched by God, etc. Even Dostoevsky, who was an epileptic himself, wrote in his book, The Idiot, he wrote, "I have really touched God. He came into me, myself. Yes, God exists. I cried. All you healthy people can't imagine the happiness which we epileptics feel during the seconds before our attack." So based on this, he started looking into the brain and wondering if there was any connection between the temporal lobe and religious feeling, religious sentiment. He started hooking these people up to electrocephalograms where he would actually read them a combination of words, some of them that were passages from their religious texts and others that were just passages from the day's newspapers. And he found that when he read religious texts or even in some cases showed them religious icons, not only did their meters go off the charts, but sometimes it would trigger their seizures, just like with some people where a light source, a flashing light, can trigger an epileptic seizure. With temporal lobe epileptics, basically, religious content or icons can trigger it for them. Then to further investigate, a man named Michael Persinger, who was studying Ramachandran's research, found this very curious, and he invented a helmet called a transcranial magnetic stimulator, which basically can electrically stimulate various regions of the brain. So he decided to take this helmet of his and point it at the temporal lobe. And what he found was that a high degree of people that he put this on, aimed at the temporal lobe, when they would take it off and ask what did they experience, they said that they actually felt this like sense of spirituality, that they felt the presence of God, etc. Then there are people who do ethnobotanical research, who basically are studying the chemistry behind the various drugs that all these different cultures have used and written about throughout the centuries to elicit a religious experience, be it the Aztecs using, you know, psilocybin or the Hopis using peyote, etc. He found that the chemistry was latching to the same region in the brain, therefore triggering these same experiences. Then you've got Jeffrey Saver at UCLA Neurologic Center. And he was a historian who started doing some studies on some of the religious prophets through history, and he found that documentation pointed to, just as Dostoevsky was a temporal lobe epileptic, so have a lot of the world's historical religious leaders. And he found that everyone from the Apostle Paul to Muhammad to Joan of Arc, in historical writings about those prophets, were supposedly temporal lobe epileptics.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. So indeed, what these people, you know, filled with ecstasy and filled with a vision of some type of, you know, some type of divine creator, perhaps they were just suffering a type of mental dysfunction that triggered these parts of the brain that generate religious, you know, religious ideology. Then Michael Persinger, the same person who created the temporal lobe transcranial magnetic stimulator, the helmet, started going to schools and asking students and doing research, basically, you know, dipping into brain research. And what he found was that 19% of high school students who expressed having had intense religious experiences while in their teens had previously suffered some sort of a head injury. So that there was actually brain trauma can be involved in religious experience as well. Again, pointing to it's all coming out of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got, following up with that, you've got Eugene DeKeeley of University of Pennsylvania now deciding to take people in the midst of meditation and prayer, people who were proclaiming that they were having a transcendental or mystical experience and wanting to see, well, what's happening in their brain. So they started taking people, they started with some Tibetan monks and asked them to meditate and put them in an MRI. And when they reached the, when they were in their peak of their transcendental experience, what they believed was transcendent, he had them pull a string, which turned the machine on and began reading their brain. He also compared these same readings with some Franciscan nuns and monks who, in the midst of prayer, not meditation, but who also were describing the same types of symptoms, a feeling of serenity, a loss of sense of self, a loss of time and space, a feeling of bliss. He also put these same people into this, what they were actually SPECT scans of the brain, and found that the same thing was occurring. And to give you a quick breakdown of some of the things that were happening in the brain, one of the things, for instance, that they found was that if you meditate or pray, your brain, the blood flow changes in your brain. So, for instance, a part of our limbic system called the amygdala gets a decreased blood flow if we meditate or pray. The amygdala is the part of the brain that generates fear and anxiety. But when we meditate or pray, it gets a decreased blood flow, therefore diluting our anxious experience and therefore filling us with feelings of serenity, tranquility, bliss. So our usual anxiety, our usual stress in life is completely dissipated when we meditate or pray. Then he found that, for instance, the brain's parietal lobe also got a decreased blood flow. And the parietal lobe...
And let me ask you, Matthew, all these researchers, they do not believe in the existence of God. Is that basically true?
No, I'm probably the most ardent in my disbelief.
Okay.
A lot of them sort of sit on the fence. I would say a lot of them are agnostics. They just kind of say that, well, I just do the research, but I'm not here to really, you know, decide on whether there's God or not. They're just brain scientists.
Okay.
And some of them are believers, and some of them aren't believers, but they don't really take the evolutionary stand that I do, basically suggesting that this is just hardwired.
So you're almost out there all by yourself.
No, there are a couple others. There's like Dennett and Dawkins and other people who are take a more atheistic approach. But yeah, I call myself a reductionist. Basically, you know, one who reduces, you know, all consciousness and concepts of human behavior to just physical properties, just biomechanics. So what they were finding was the parietal lobe where our sense of time and space is generated. Basically, our biological clock is in the parietal lobe, gets a decreased blood flow. So we lose our normal sense of time and space, giving us this sort of ethereal sense like we're just sort of lost in the cosmos. So it's often described as like a cosmic experience, a cosmic consciousness, a one with the all. Another part of the experience is you get a decreased blood flow to your right frontal lobe, which is where sort of ego consciousness is generated, sort of our sense of self. So we meditate or pray, that gets a decreased blood flow, and our normal sense of self is also dissipated. So we feel this sense of selflessness, of, again, described as dissolution of normal ego boundaries. And these are symptoms described by every culture from every continent. It's always the same description of what this experience entails. What is a mystical experience? And it's because no matter what culture you're from, we're the same species. And basically, our experience neurophysiologically is pretty much a constant if we meditate or pray. So this is what's going on in the brain.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, these are the neuromechanics of spiritual experience.
When you look out into the vastness of space, mm-hmm. and you see the planets and the stars and the constellations, mm-hmm. what do you think, Matthew? What do you say to yourself? How did this get here? How did there seem to be order in the universe? There seems to be a reason for things.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is, again, my take on it, which is probably unlike most people's, is I believe that all perception, we've got this, you know, container in our head, the brain, and all of our intelligence, all consciousness, all sensation comes from this bundle of nerves in our head. This organ evolved to make us a survivable animal in this very particular environment called planet Earth. And in specific regions of planet Earth, be it hotter or colder, our brains aren't really wired, because it wasn't necessary for us to know cosmic realities. So I believe that for us to even venture into trying to come up with solutions to, like, where did it come from and what is the nature of infinity and what was at the beginning of time, are basically we're out of our element. It's not even within our capacity, having this small organ, the brain, which makes us a very functional creature here on Earth, but really wasn't wired to give us insight into, like, beginnings or endings of time. We have a very sort of set sense of, you know, temporal dimension, and it doesn't include eternity or infinity. So for us to even try and solve such problems, I believe, again, we're out of our element. So when I think of those things, I just think, honestly, I don't know. I do believe in Big Bang Theory. I believe that this universe was created approximately 13 billion years ago.
Do you believe that there is order to all of this?
I believe, yeah. I mean, I believe in the laws of thermodynamics. They seem to be the set principles that guide all physical reality.
What about an energy out there, an intelligent energy? Let's not even call it God.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume for a moment your mm-hmm. theory is correct about that. But what about in the universe that mm-hmm. there is something that is, I don't know, so intelligent that everything just seems to flow from it? Could you accept that theory?
You know what? You might as well say, why don't we presume that there's a, you know, a dancing pink leprechaun somewhere in the outer reaches of the cosmos, and he's in charge of everything? Or there's an intelligent unicorn, you know? I mean, for me, it's like that's the floating pink elephant.
So you either believe or you don't.
There's no reason for me to suspend disbelief just to say, yeah, what the heck? Maybe there is some floating conscious entity. Personally, I would need the proof. I would need for that conscious entity to one day come down and land on Earth or fly to Earth or however he travels or it travels and to introduce himself. But in the meantime, there's no reason for me to believe that, and there's no reason to presume that there are imaginary entities when there's really no, you know, otherwise verifiable proof to support such a notion. So I would tend to say, yeah, sure, why not? Certainly possible, but, you know, so is anything. So is a creature with 500 heads, you know, that all look like chickens, and it's the most intelligent creature out there, and it's in sector 10 of the Quadrant B of the fifth galaxy out of some sci-fi book.
Well, why aren't you wired this way then? If other people are wired to believe in God, why aren't you?
Well, it's a very good question. And for that very question, I have a chapter in the God part of the brain called Why Are There Atheists? I don't necessarily believe that this is the explanation for me. I believe that I'm actually a fairly spiritual person, because had I not been, I don't think I would have put the type of time and energy into this pursuit that I had. It's just that I also believe I'm also a skeptic and I'm also a very logical person. So I think in the end, when I came up with a cognitive solution, my logical side kind of outweighed my spiritual side. Nevertheless, I do believe that there are, because, you know, one of the questions that people generally throw at me, like, okay, if you're saying we're wired this way, how do you explain atheists, those who don't believe? So in the chapter, Why Are There Atheists?, I basically explain it as such. For every trait that we possess, and this is like a basically evolutionary principle, we fall into a bell curve. So we could take something very simple like a physical trait like height, and for the most part, we fall into a bell curve. Most, because of genetic variance, most humans fall into that bulge of the bell curve. We are what we could call the mean of the bell curve, and we fall into a category of what we might call average height. And on the tapering extremes, you have some people who are born excessively tall and some people who are born excessively short. We could apply that now to a cognitive trait, like let's say humans are wired to be, we're a musical animal. We have parts of our brain that make us a musical animal, that generate musical ability. With that in mind, if we apply the same bell curve, it would suggest that the bulge of humanity, the masses of humanity, have average musical potential. It's a means by which we communicate. If you took someone from any culture in any continent and put them on a culture where they didn't speak their language, they could still clap a rhythm and everyone in the room would be able to follow them. So it's kind of a universal language because there are parts of a brain that generate this. But at the same time, on the tapering extremes of this capacity, you have some people born very highly wired for musical ability. So you have like musical geniuses, musical savants, sometimes in some cases idiot savants, which is proof of the wiring behind music, in which you have people who can't tie their own shoelaces, but if you play them a Beethoven sonata and they hear it just once, they'll be able to play it note for note. And on the other side of that tapering extreme, you have people born tone deaf, people who are non-musical, who you could sit there, you could have the greatest instructors in the world teach them music for 20 years, and at the end they won't be able to hum Happy Birthday.
True. Couldn't hold a tune.
Right, because they're... So now let's apply that to spirituality and religiosity. What it's going to suggest is that the bulge of the bell curve, the average human, is going to have average religious capacity, an average predisposition to have a sense that there's something else out there, and to get comfort in that sense, and to hook up with some organization, some social group that basically is an organized around that belief system, which we call a religion. But on the tapering extremes, there are some who are born hyper-religious, people who as children are giving heartfelt sermons from the pulpit, who we say are born with the spirit in them. And then on the other extreme, you're going to have people who are born what we could call, you know, the equivalence of being musically tone deaf. They're spiritually tone deaf. They just don't get it. You can sit there and talk about God and spirit, and it's like trying to teach music to a tone deaf person. It's just not within their capacity to even understand. So, and then you have people, and again, I'm not suggesting that all of it is genetic. A lot of it is you know, socialization as well. So certainly, you know, if someone's an atheist or a non-believer, that could be partly due to the fact that they were raised to not to not believe, and at the same time, it might also be partly because their genes dictated that they're not particularly wired to have that perception. Now, again, was I wired with a disability to my spiritual belief? Probably not, because like I said, as a child, I felt those sensations. And even to this day, I mean, I can meditate and I can tap into those feelings. I just don't believe what they're suggesting they might be. I don't believe that I've transcended. So,
all right, well, Matthew, when we come back, let's talk about faith for a moment. And then next hour, phone calls. We'll be back in a moment. Okay, we'll take your phone calls next hour with our guest, Matthew Alper, but I'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Matthew, let's talk about faith now, the part of what so many of us grasp onto, because we really don't have definitive proof, not really. Some of us think we may when we have visitations and things like that from those that we care about who have gone on to the other side. But what about the faith, the just believing without having the hard proof?
Well, again, I'm going to just refer it back to, you know, my book and the ideas within, which is just suggesting that we are hardwired for faith. We're hardwired with this, basically the human animal, we could say, has a dualistic perception of reality. Every culture, no matter how isolated, has had this sense that there's the physical world, but then has had this belief and written about it and talked about it, this other realm, this spiritual realm, which is kind of unusual for a species of skeptics as ourselves to be believing in things that we can't see or taste or touch or hear. But nevertheless, we tend to believe. Now, if we were in a room full of people, and this could go pretty much in any culture in the world, if we were sitting in a room of 100 people and somebody shouted out that he, you know, felt the presence of a invisible flying elephant hovering around the room, chances are he would be held down and medicated. But if someone else on the other side of the room said, I feel the spirits of the deceased in the room, nobody would think to medicate that person. Half the people in the room would even nod and go, yeah, I feel it too. And you have to wonder, that's very unusual, again, for a species of skeptics as ourselves, when there's no proof, there's no, we don't see that spirit, but everyone's nodding their heads saying, yeah, I feel it too. And I think it's because, again, we have this hardwiring that just compels us to perceive these things.
You've never had a paranormal experience in your life?
Well, no. Well, see, first of all, I wouldn't call them paranormal. Like, for instance, when I was a teenager, I remember I had experiences that, as I started researching, I found that they were what were described as out-of-body experiences.
Right.
They were very unusual, and they were kind of like lucid dreaming, and I wasn't really sure what they were. And again, I was skeptical. It was like, wow, is that me transcending? Is that like my soul somehow having its own vision while I'm sleeping and somehow having this alternate reality going on? And I didn't know, but it was experiences like that that piqued my curiosity and said, this is stuff I have to investigate. Now, having been a student of the brain, even things like out-of-body experiences or what are called, you know, otherwise known as astral projections, have been reduced to neurophysiology, where they're finding that there are different regions in the brain that generate these types of hallucinations. And they're very similar, for instance, to the notion of like a phantom limb. You know, we can feel this sensibility that even if a limb is missing, there are people who have a feeling that it's really there. And they have an experience where they'll describe the arm moving around or picking something up, because basically perception comes from the brain. And if we're hardwired with these perceptions that there are these alternate experiences, and they tend to bolster our religious beliefs, which is what they're there for, you know, I can understand why people believe them, and I believe them once too, or just at least was uncertain, but willing at least to question the possibility.
Well, how do you believe, how do you come up with the answer of everything that has existed in the universe?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you think created it? How did it get here?
Again, what I was saying before, that the brain really, that we're out of our element to ask questions like that. I don't think it's within our capacity to know. It's in our nature to ask why and to seek out origins of things, because when we know where things come from, we have a better grasp on how to handle them. So it's our nature to look for where and why and how, you know, and when. But I don't think that it's in our capacity to ever understand like the true nature of time. We understand human time. You know, a cat understands cat time. He doesn't even understand human time. You know, a fly understands fly time. Humans, because of the nature of our brains, understand human time and none other. Our perception of time is very limited, and when we start trying to apply it to notions beyond us or exceeding us, such as, you know, where did it all begin, I have no idea where it all began, why it all began. I don't believe that just because I can't explain those things, it necessitates the existence of some type of transcendental being, whether you want to call it energy or the Judeo-Christian God, however you want to define it. The minute you start ascribing spiritual status to some imaginary, elusive entity, I think that that's just us projecting outward again. That's just the human brain looking, projecting as it's wired to do so out onto the universe and saying there must be some power out there. You know, when we're infants, you know, reaching out blindly from the crib, you know, we have faith that if we cry, someone's going to lean over and pick us up. We have this sense of this strong figure out there. And we haven't even maybe even opened our eyes. We don't even know what it looks like. We just know that if we need and we beseech, it will come and it will help us. And I think that our perception and our belief in God is some type of extension of our paternal and maternal instincts as children to reach out for needed help. And as we get older and we realize that against inevitable death, not even our biological mother or father can save us, then the brain somehow got rewired to like reach out to some other entity. So it's in our nature to find this entity, to seek out that like paternal figure in the sky, when again, I don't believe one exists. And you could say, well, why not this and why not that? Why not an energy creature and why not this creature? And again, I would say, well, okay, why not? But why? You know, give me validation. Have them sign an autograph and then get it notarized and we'll look into it.
God, it's not going to happen that way though, Matthew. You know that.
Well, I know that because I know that he's not out there.
I know, I'm
a frustrating being. I'm well aware.
I can't wait to open up the phone lines. I'm very curious to see how they're going to come at you.
Yeah, in many forms.
But you'll stand your ground, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
When you, I guess a lot of people talk to you about this and about the book, The God Part of the Brain. Mm-hmm. I mean, do they ever just lose their temper with you?
Well, I've definitely received my share of hate mail.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yeah. It's popping up as we speak, you know, at my godpart@AOL.com address. I'm getting it all the time. And whenever I do Art Show or your show, you know, the skeptics come at me. And it's unfortunate because really I'm just looking to try and, you know, just another way, another form of trying to find a solution to what's it all about. And I don't think there's any need to be antagonistic. And in the end, I'm actually trying to offer a peaceful philosophy, because what I'm suggesting is that in the end of all things, really all I'm suggesting is that we're wired for this potentially very destructive impulse for religiosity, which causes discrimination and acts of genocide and war. And as we see, as we've seen through all of history and we're seeing in our present day, you know, civilization is threatened with unraveling at the seams as a result of this religious impulse. And I'm just hoping that maybe before it's too late, we'll sort of get a sense of our biologies and learn to deal with it from a scientific perspective and maybe be able to therefore temper the more extreme and dangerous, you know, parts of this religious impulse. Maybe hold on to the more productive parts, but until we do, you know, we've got something to reckon with. You know, and I heard during the commercials your interview about Ahmadinejad, and, you know, I agree with your philosophy there. The guy's a nutcase, and he threatens, you know, basically civilization as we know it. And, but in the end, it really comes down to, you know, to religion, that we've got these paradigms, and we hold on to them so wholeheartedly. And we need to prove, even if it means killing our neighbors, that our version is the right one. So it's a very dangerous and destructive thing. And in the end, I'm really just hoping that, like, this philosophy and this paradigm, this cognitive paradigm, can really, in the end, just only add to help spreading the peace. you know, and helping contain war and helping contain anger and antagonism for those who believe other than what we believe. So, yeah, I get a lot of antagonism and I get a lot of, you know, frustrated dates who don't want to hear why I don't believe in the Zodiac, et cetera.
Do you believe in extraterrestrial life? Do you think that's possible?
I absolutely think that's possible, because that would fall into the realm of biology. Do I believe that we've had contact with such things? Probably not. Just the mere physics of it, the closest star, which is Alpha Centauri, is like 6 trillion light years away. It would take so long just for us to reach the closest star, let alone ones in the more distant galaxy. So is it possible that there are other life forms? Definitely.
But you're thinking conventionally. I mean, I would think that if there's a civilization a billion years ahead of us, mm-hmm. they figured out another way to get here. I mean, they're not coming through the same kind of propulsion system we are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know what? All of those things are definitely possible. And it is possible that there was a life form that evolved a billion years ago. I mean, terrestrial life is 3.2 billion years old from the first living cells. So it's possible that in some other galaxy, intelligent life has been around for a billion years, and they've had a long time to come up with all types of alternate technologies that we haven't even yet to dream of.
What about these ancient civilizations on this planet who may have witnessed visitations thinking they were gods?
Well, again, I would, being a skeptic, I don't believe that such things happened. I believe that... first of all, you have like the Aztecs, and the Aztecs were astronomers, and they did notice like Halley's Comet and shooting stars and falling meteorites, and they were an imaginative people, and for them to come up with that there are other, you know, creatures out there, you know, alien life forms, I think, you know, there's no reason to believe that they shouldn't come up with those concepts, but I don't necessarily believe that they were actually visited. Is it possible? Yes. Do I think that there's enough evidence? No. I mean, when the first Europeans came on horseback, you know, they thought those were gods. They thought those were centaurs. So, you know, these were people who, you know, had a very primitive understanding of what reality was. They weren't educated in a Western way like we are. And, you know, if they saw a whale jump out of the water, the next thing they're drawing pictures of some, like, five-legged dragon creature. You know, so, I mean, if you don't have, you know, the kind of scientific backing that we do today, then you're just left with the imagination to run amok, which I think is most of what's happened through human history. But again, I don't know with definitive proof one way or the other.
Are most scientists non-believers?
I think that the Scientific American did a poll about 10 years ago. And I think that they found that a high percentage of scientists were theists, did believe in some form of a spiritual reality. I think it was well over 50%. It might have been like 65%.
That is a high percent.
It is a high percent. But that doesn't surprise me because, again, given what I'm saying, all humans are hardwired, or most humans, the majority are hardwired this way. So even if you're like a math genius, even if you're wired to be like incredibly mathematically brilliant, it doesn't belie that you would also be, you know, a spiritual person. So we have these different mechanisms in the brain, these different intelligences that are generated from different regions in the brain, and they don't necessarily contradict one another. You would think that a mathematician would just stick to numbers, and that's all he would believe. But lo and behold, just as much as a mathematician can also happen to be very musical or very emotional, he might also happen to be very spiritual, or not even very, but just like as much as the next guy, which is enough to make him go to church and pray and believe in something.
Do you think that most religions were set up to create some kind of order in society, that without it, there'd be chaos, panic?
Well, I think that that was one of the adaptive mechanics behind this selection of this religious impulse. As I said, I think it was a group dynamic. You know, given that humans are a social creature, you know, it was one of the ways by which communities, human communities, were bonded and given, you know, a set of laws and customs and rituals, yes, to keep us in order, to keep us operating effectively. Unfortunately, however, it comes with all the trimmings of the politics of a church, and it comes with having to believe in, you know, mythological realities, which if we're not going to believe in any one of them, we might as well not believe in any of them. Because obviously, if we believe in one, we don't believe in all the others. So in a sense, you know, you could say, I'm an atheist, but everyone who even believes in some religion, well, in a sense, they might be a believer in one religion, but then they're an atheist for the other 10,000 religions out there that have existed through history. So for 10,000 cultures, every believer would be called an atheist because they don't believe in their gods.
Does it bother you if someone is a believer?
Not at all. I don't care if someone believes that the Grinch stole Christmas, as long as they're like a decent person. I think that's what it comes down to. I think that if all the religious, you know, paradigms out in the world didn't promote discrimination or antagonism or violence against one another, and there was an accepted communal understanding of world brotherhood and peace and tolerance, and then after that, believe what you want, I would have no problem at all with any religion, and I'd say, you know, all the power to it. But unfortunately, it tends to be a little more destructive than that.
If we're hardwired, Matthew, why are we? Why did it happen genetically, biologically?
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of went over that earlier when I was talking about that. I believe that it came as a result of self-conscious awareness. That this capacity that evolved in humans that made us the most powerful species on Earth, in becoming aware of our own existences, became aware of our own non-existences of death. And the anxiety of being aware of our own mortalities and the inevitability of death, and that there's nothing we can do to prevent it, caused so much anxiety in the human animal that nature was forced to select some type of cognitive modification, some type of adaptive mechanism, a coping mechanism that would help us survive, so that over a period of time in the evolution of the hominids, what happened was nature kind of rewired us to have this perception that there's this other realm, other than the physical, and we're part of it, and we're composed in it, so that even though the physical body is going to die, we now are wired with this perception that there's this other part, this spirit. And even though when the body dies, the spirit will live on, thus relieving us of the you know, mortal anxiety that came with being aware of our own deaths, and allowing us to sort of get on with our daily needs without having to suffer a paralytic stroke from being aware of the horror of death without any reconciliation to that, no any consolation to that. So I refer to this mechanism as nature's white lie. That basically, to keep humans alive, to make us a survivable creature amidst our vast intelligence, nature kind of had to lie to us and put a delusion in our head just to help us cope with the horrible reality of that we're here for a short time, and then in a blink of the eye, it's gone.
All right. Well, you stay with us, Matthew. When we come right back at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines, which have been ringing since you've been on. The God part of the brain. Matthew's website is godpart.com. That's linked up also as well at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment.